Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome, everyone, to the Really 007 podcast. I'm Tom Pickup, and we're here for a very special interview with a very special guest and a Bond girl. It's great to have a Bond girl on the show. So our fans know how much we love the Timothy Dalton films and his era as James Bond, and we've spoken to an array of guests from Tim's two films. But now we have one of the best Bond girls in the history of the 007 franchise. We all agree with that. We have Mariam Darbo, who, of course, played Cara Milovi in The Living Daylights. So welcome.
Hello there. Good afternoon, everybody. Hello.
Great to see you, Mariam. Thank you for coming. You can watch all our other interviews on our YouTube channel. We've got iTunes and Spotify if you want to listen to them as well. And yes, please subscribe and enjoy those. They're all there. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you can find more silly interactions between Bond fans across the world. But today I have with me esteemed Really 007 contributors. I have a power couple. We have Chris and Jess Goldie here.
So
good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah.
And I've also got my brother Matthew. So it's Tom and Matthew here, Mariam.
Okay. Hiya. Good to meet you all.
Yeah. Brilliant to meet you, Mariam. So yes, Mariam's obviously had a very long career in film, television, and on stage with a wide variety of productions in many different countries as well. Of course, though, as Bond fans, we best know her as Timothy Dalton's first Bond girl, Cara Milovi, one of the stars of The Living Daylights. So it's just great to have you here, Mariam.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't play the cello.
we were going to ask you that, yeah. It looks very convincing, though.
I had 4 weeks of rehearsing the movements with the cello teacher of all the Dvorak pieces, concertos for a cello that they shot. They basically soak the bow with dry soap, so you take the sound away. And then I just had to learn how to, mind the movements and look as if I was playing. So it was not easy, I'll tell you that. My fingers were like pretty much hurting on the strings and I had to keep my back straight and it was, and look very convincing. But I had an amazing teacher, cello teacher, who was Eastern European. She was actually Czech. And so it was, it was a really interesting getting the knowledge about musicians, about cellists, about practicing with the Symphony Orchestra in Vienna and with John Barry conducting. So it was really, really great, very exciting, thrilling.
Yeah, just to have John Barry there as well on stage with you, that must have been amazing.
It was thrilling. I mean, I saw John Barry quite a bit on the film set at Pinewood Studios because he was composing the music for our film, for The Living Daylights. So saw quite a lot of him and his wife, Laurie Barry, great friends of Barbara Broccoli's. So they were always around, they were very supportive. But having John Barry conduct was amazing. And I really felt like I was playing with this orchestra that was sort of carrying me and lifting me, making me believe that I was actually making sound and playing.
my wife played the cello and she was very convinced. Yeah, it's not easy, is it? It's even if you pretend it's not easy.
I know, you have to start when you're about 8 years old, you know, if you really want to become a good musician.
Yeah.
So that's one of the hardest string instruments anyway.
Yeah, well, it's incredibly convincing for only 4 weeks of...
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I have to thank my teacher for that and for John Glenn, the way I was shot.
Well, we've actually spoken to John Glenn and he spoke very highly of you. And of course, all the other actors we've spoke to just say he was just so effortless with the actors. He let them do what they wanted and sort of expressed...
John's very chilled and... Because he comes from an editor background and he's edited all the shots in his head, obviously from the script, but he's got it quite succinct. You see, he knows exactly methodically how every shot's got to be done, most of the time anyway. And he loves actors and he's a really gentle person. So it was really nice to have him supporting us and on board, and very confident on the way he was shooting it, what shot he was going to do. So you didn't feel like you were dealing with somebody who had no idea. And because it was, I think it was his number 7 Bond film that he was directing, or number 6, because he'd done, you know, most of the Roger Moores, he was very comfortable. It's like the Broccolis were his sort of part of the family for him. So it was really, really, really nice to have John as a director. Really enjoyed it.
It was a family. We've been hearing this as well. Of course, there was Cubby. Barbara was there, I believe. Was she quite young at the time?
Barbara was exactly my age. And she was learning the steps of producing, you know, under her father's thumb. And so Cubby was really the last Bond film that he physically produced, you know, because the second one that he did with Timothy Dalton that he produced, he got very ill. So Barbara and Michael took over. Most of it. It was a very difficult shoot with the one they did in Mexico City. So we're not saying that the one in Morocco and Vienna was easy, but I think it was a much sort of easier shoot in the sense that there was less pressure. It was more manageable in Morocco, you know, and in Vienna. And I think Mexico, they had quite a few problems at the studio and communications and all of that. It was just more stressful, and particularly because Cubby was sick. So I was very lucky to have Cubby Broccoli on the Living Daylights, because he was such a wonderful energy, wonderful, you know, leadership, and loved his crew enormously. So he wanted to make sure the crew was happy when we were in Morocco. And there were, you know, a few moments when the crew were missing English food or sort of Western food when we were in the desert in Ouazzazate. So Cubby had a plane. Well, I mean, he brought over on one of the flights pasta from Italy and Barbara cooked all the pasta in the hotel for the crew.
Wow.
You know, and because I think there was a few runny tummies going on amongst the crew. So, you know, Cubby was always there to make sure his crew was happy. And his cast, of course, And really, no, it's a real family affair working on a Bond movie. And I don't think you'll meet anybody, any actor who's had a bad experience on a Bond film.
Not that we've spoken to, certainly, no.
No.
They all loved it.
No.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, in terms of kind of obviously saying that this is, you know, Cubby's been producing these films, you know, since day one. And, you know, this is a new Bond. This is, you know, Timothy's first film. This feels like there's quite a sort of sea change in, you know, the approach to making a sort of modern Bond film. Was that kind of discussed at the beginning, that this is going to be maybe a slightly more grounded or mature kind of approach to what was, you know, obviously a very long-standing series?
Well, every time they bring a new actor to play Bond, they have to, they bring a new style to Bond. And of course, it's a few years later, so the times have changed and they have to adapt to the actual, you know, current times of that film that's going to be made. So we did it in 1986, 1987, from September till February, I think, 87. And of course, there was a lot of prep that went in with Timothy, because originally Timothy was not playing it. It was Pierce Brosnan who was playing it. And he got so much publicity that his TV series that he was doing in America got picked up again, and he was under contract, so he couldn't get out of it. And Timothy was approached, and I think Timothy had been approached way before, and felt that he was maybe at some point when Roger Moore was maybe, you know, getting on, I can't remember, but Timothy had been approached before and had said no, because he felt he was not, he was too young or not right for it. And the second time he was approached, from what I understand and remember, he was he loved the idea, but he wanted to make sure that everybody was on the same page as far as how he felt he could deliver a good Bond, a classic Bond, going back to the books, and nothing to do with the way Roger Moore brought his own personality and his wit, charm, you know. In fact, Roger Moore brought himself on the screen and made Bond his own.
Yeah.
But and Timothy's a very different character, very different personality. He really wanted to bring the character that Ian Fleming had created in the books, and wanted to be very close to that. So because of that, the whole style changes, you know, the style of from the costumes to the way it's going to be shot to the whole attitude of Bond, also his relationship with the ladies, the Bond girls. And it was a period that was more austere, you know. It's when suddenly you had the AIDS crisis going on and all sorts of things. And they decided to go to a more personable relationship between the leading Bond girl and James Bond, and make it more, bring more sensitivity, a bit more humanity. And of course, I played a role that had no superpowers, you know. I certainly was not Pussy Galore, you know, with superpowers. I was just a musician, you know, that was who came from the East, from Bratislava, and wanted to move to the West for a career. Mm. And that's where James Bond, her rescue, her prince, you know, takes her. So there was that sort of, you know, romantic, more romantic notion of more of a relationship between the two of them.
I don't understand. Why are you trying to help me?
What did Pushkin want? Did he ask you about Yorgi Koskov?
He wanted to know where he was.
Did you tell him?
No.
It was clever of Yorgi, using blanks. Made the British believe his defection was real.
How do you know that?
He told me.
You saw him?
2 days ago. He's safe and sound.
You're a friend of his?
We've been through quite a lot together.
Dear Georgi, he kept his promise sent for me. Where are we going? To London?
No, not yet. The British think he'll be safer if they keep him moving around for a while. We might catch up with him in Vienna.
Vienna?
We must leave immediately. Before they pick you up again.
But how?
We'll manage. Get packed, bring some warm clothes.
And also, I think Timothy Dalton played the character less of a flirty, you know, way with the women, more of a loner, more of a thoughtful Bond, and more of a loner. In fact, like, a lot like in the books, in Ian Fleming's early, you know, books that he wrote. So, of course, you know, he was always desired and attracted to beautiful women. And in a way, James Bond is like Ulysses, isn't he? Crossing and coming across all those sirens on his path.
Yeah.
And some stop him and divert him, and some others, you know, get crushed on the way. But I was lucky I survived and managed to get to the West and perform first concerts, you know, on the West side of the block.
I think that one of the most sort of striking things about the film is your relationship with Bond, about how believable it is. And there is that, like you mentioned, there is a sense of romance about it. That it's not, like you say, not disposable characters, that you feel that you're part of the plot, but actually driving it, you have a sense of, you know, you have agency, which sadly I'll say that a lot about a lot of female characters, not just in Bond films, but in films in general. So I think every time I go back and watch it, I think it's feels like such a modern film. Because I do think in the past few years, I feel like that's we've regressed a little bit in the depiction of female characters. And, you know, that there are certain kind of beats that films have to make nowadays. And like you said, this sort of like box ticking, I just think it feels like really fresh. And, you know, if you'd showed that to someone, you know, this is the first Bond film, you'd think this was made, you know, in the past decade. It feels, the action is great. It is beautifully shot, I think.
You didn't find it politically incorrect?
Only in the sense that was what the politics were at the time.
I know.
Things changed.
No, that's why when I haven't seen it in a while, but we did have a celebration at Pinewood Studios with cast and crew 27 years after we'd done the film.
Yeah.
And they did a screening, and I laughed the whole way through. I mean, I thought it was hilariously funny and quite sweet, actually. I was quite endeared by it, but I just thought it was hilarious because the whole politics had completely changed.
Yeah.
The Russians were not were there at the time, you know, in Afghanistan, and so the Mujahideens were the heroes, which a lot of them, you know, turned out to be Taliban and extremists. Yeah. But not all of them, but because the term Mujahideen means freedom fighters. So, but at the time they were fighting for their freedom, you know, against the Russian occupation. Mm. So I just thought it was absolutely hilarious. And I really thought it was very funny to watch for me, you know. And some of my lines are just like, oh my God, you're so naive. But then, you know, she was a musician and she was her age then and she was...
Yeah.
But of course, I was watching it not from the same perspective anymore. But it was an endearing relationship between Tim and Kara, well, James Bond and Kara Milovi, because also, well, there was more heart in the screenplay for her role, more thought and more heart put in those few scenes that we had together. But also, Timothy was a lovely actor to work with, very supportive. You know, real pro, very caring, you know, actor. So, of course, he wanted me to be as good as I could be, and we'd both be good in the scene. So, yeah, it was good because I could never be fake with him. I always, you know, I always had to bring a reality, an emotional reality in our scenes with him because he brought that. I'm very supportive of Timothy having played James Bond. I know everybody has... It's a generational thing and people have their different opinions. But I think at the time, I think he was really, a big change in the times to bring this Bond that he brought, which was more thoughtful, more of a loner, more, you know, just more solid, like in the books. So I loved working with him and I don't know what it would have been like working with Pierce, but anyway... Tim was my
boss. Vienna's beautiful, just like Jorgi said.
You care for him a great deal, don't you?
I owe him everything. My scholarship at the Conservatoire, my Strad.
Your cello's a Stradivarius.
A famous one, the Lady Rose. Jorgi got it in New York.
Quite a present.
Maybe someday I'll play there, at Carnegie Hall. Jorgi believes I can do it.
I'm sure he's right.
We go to him now?
Yeah, unless he had to move on. If he did, I'm sure he left a message.
Could I ask about the audition process and your casting, if that's okay, Mariam?
It's a funny story because we started shooting in, I think, October 86. And in the beginning of, I think, in February 1986, my agent from ICM called me up and said, look, I'm doing screen tests at Pinewood Studios, trying to cast the lead actor for James Bond, to play James Bond. And they need an actress to be there to do the scene from Russia with Love. And they're going to do like a proper shoot, you know, a proper screen test at Pinewood Studios. And Covey Broccoli will be there and John Glenn's going to be directing the screen test. And you will be paid for the day. And... because I was free, and also because Cubby would get to meet, you know, me as an actress, and see how I worked, you know, in the screen test for, you know, future of knowing, we've seen Mariam and she might be good one day for a role. I think, you know, he liked to get to know his actresses or see what they could do. And so it was a day's shoot at Pinewood. I did it with quite a well-known actor in France. It was a marvellous actor called Lambert Wilson. He did a very, very good screen test to play James Bond. But, you know, it's a committee meeting between the studios and the Broccolis, and they decided that Lambert Wilson was not right. Maybe he was, I don't know, an old-fashioned Bond. He's a marvellous actor. He does a lot of theatre. He's a big name in France. Right. He's completely bilingual. In fact, we went to the same drama school in London at Drama Centre, but he's French, but he's totally bilingual. I see him on stage in Paris, and we always laugh about it because he says, "You just came in to feed the lines and you're the one who got the part." That was that. And then I went off to do a movie in Germany, Laughter in the Dark, a Nabokov novel adapted to the screen, set in 1930s in Berlin, with Maximilian Schell, Sandy Dennis, Ed Herman, and there was going to be Mick Jagger. But anyway, the whole film collapsed after, I think, 3-4 weeks shooting we did at in Munich at the studios in Munich, because the money didn't come through. There was some sort of this Eastern European producer, but the money, not all the money was coming through, was rolling in. So the movie stopped. But I had changed a lot for this film. That's why I'd lost quite a bit of weight, because the film collapsed and it was quite a thing. And, you know, and I had a very different look. I had hair cut, you know, sort of 1930s Berlin. And I looked much more Slavic and Eastern European. And so that was that, and it was quite hard for us to sort of, you know, leave a film halfway through. And the first time director of this film, Laughter in the Dark, showed it, edited the months of the 3-4 weeks shooting into a 20-minute film, and showed it to studios in America to see if he could get the finance to continue the film. And one of the studios that saw it was United Artists, which is now MGM. And United Artists, you know, were at the time doing the Bond movies. So they hadn't cast they'd cast Pierce Brosnan, and they hadn't cast their leading actress to play this Czechoslovakian cellist. They couldn't find her, apparently. And I had no idea of all of this going on. I just moved on and didn't even think twice about it. And I just happened to bump into Barbara Broccoli at the health club. And she did a double take because I changed physically a lot. And she decided to tell her father to bring me in at Pinewood for an interview with John Glenn and everybody, because I changed. I was just very different. I think when I did the screen test early February 1986, I looked, you know, I had long hair. I wasn't as sculpted because I had more baby fat. I was I lost quite a bit of weight on the Nabokov film in Germany, because it was quite tense, stress, there's a lot of stuff going on. So I just looked, you know, I just had a completely different look and feel. And the studio in LA, United Artists, liked me and thought I'd be from seeing me in the film, the 20-minute cut of Laughter in the Dark. And they all decided that I was the one. So I just got a call one day coming out of a singing lesson from my agent saying that I got the role, and I was completely flabbergasted. It was the last thing I was expecting, because I hadn't really heard anything, except I went for an interview and I saw everybody was going for interviews, and I just met them. I didn't audition for them or anything. I just met them. And that was it. You know, I was cast, and we started shooting in October. So the whole thing was very surreal for me, because I obviously never saw myself being a Bond girl, you know, being in a Bond film. So it was kind of a dream, but I didn't have much time to think, because there's a lot of work to do, learning how to horseback ride properly.
Yeah.
Cello, you know, costumes, prepping, and all of that. There was just a lot, and then doing, you know, all the press stuff, because we did to do a big press conference in Vienna. So there was one was busy. Very, very busy.
Quite the ride.
Yeah.
But it was great. Yeah, it was quite a ride. And then we were 2 weeks in Vienna, and then we went to Morocco, and Morocco was amazing. We were in Tangier and in Ouarzazate, which was incredible. The desert, getting up at dawn, and most amazing skyline. And and then I had a beautiful Arabic horse there, white, gorgeous. And we went, we had to sort of, you know, get used to our horses. So with all the stuntmen and the actors, we'd go riding and come back at dusk with the stuntmen. And I was very chuffed because I was the only female riding with all of the stuntmen and Timothy and Art Malik, you know. Maybe there was a stunt woman who was there, I can't remember, but I just felt like I was in Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, because actually for a civilian, Cara does get stuck into quite a lot of action, doesn't she?
Yeah.
You know, say she horse rides, she shoots, mm-hmm. she shoots a rifle, doesn't she?
Well, shooting a gun, perfect casting. Shooting a gun was perfect casting because I'm terrified of guns. I can't stand guns and the noise it makes. So it was absolute perfect casting because I didn't know how to shoot with a gun, with a shotgun.
Yeah.
So I guess they did a good casting.
Yeah. And did you have a practice of riding in a cello case down the side of a mountain?
Well, we spent, I think we spent about 2-3 days doing all of that sequence, and certainly a day and a half doing the cello. And that was also quite stressful for me because I'm scared of, as I said, gunshots, bullets and all of that. And they put, you know, underneath the snow, these little pops so that when the cello went down the slope, it looked like they were shooting at us and you'd hear. And I was like, you know, like that. And it was quite cold. And I had the controls on my side of the cello case. And Hugh, that's my husband. Timothy was obviously twice my weight. So the cello, I had a hard time controlling it for it to go straight down the slope. And sometimes it wanted to go down into the ravine. Other times it wanted to go towards the camera crew. And then at the end, when we arrived at the bottom of the slope, because it would speed quite fast, I had to brake. And once we kind of like spinned and Tim, we all spinned and Tim was like, oh, a bit, you know, shocked. I think he even slightly hurt his neck or whatever it was. Yes, it was quite stressful, that whole sequence. Of course, all the long shots were done with stunts, but there's a lot of shots that we did ourselves.
Glad I insisted you brought that cello.
And other shots which were much easier where we were actually attached to a car when it was the close-ups on us. But we did spend, you know, at least 2 days doing all of that filming in the cello case. So I won't forget it. I don't think the audience has either.
No, wonderful.
No, it was good. A very inventive idea. That was probably the most stressful stunt for me to do, because I did a little bit easy stunts in Morocco, but very easy. I mean, all the real stunts done with I had a stunt double called, I think she was called Helen, and then Nick Gillard, I remember. I had two stunt doubles with wigs.
All right, okay.
To do all the very difficult stunts, but I did one or two easy ones, you know, like jumping off a wall and following Timothy you know, and got an applause because they were going to do it in two shots. But John Glenn said, you know, if you follow Tim and you're willing to jump whatever, how many feet it was off the wall, I'll just keep the camera rolling. And I did. And so little things like that. And the horse riding, there were quite a few shots with the horse, but a lot of it also was done with Nick Gillard, who was my stunt double. I had the most beautiful horse. Sadly, the horses when we were there were catching this virus they had of a cough, like some form of a pneumonia that they had. It was terrible. A lot of those horses were, you know, but no, it was Morocco was very, you know, it was hard work, but it was very exhausting. It was beautiful and fun.
Yeah. Did you find the sort of the experience of making, you know, a Bond film was almost like sort of boot camp for further, you know, projects where you get thrown into this huge machine of stunts and this and then acting?
Yeah, you get thrown in on a huge machine, a big Hollywood movie. So yeah, it's completely different from working on a low budget, that's for sure. So yeah, no, it's and it demands discipline. Of course, there are some pluses from a low budget. So low budget, you work 6 days a week. And now it's like more than like 12 hours a day and you don't have time off, or even sometimes now it's 7 days a week, you know. And there we had, I think, most weekends, well, one weekend off, you know, out of two weekends. And then you would have one Sunday off. You know what I mean? 2 days, one weekend and then one day. They were very respectful of the time, of making sure the actors were okay, were not overworked. But we did, you know, you have to work hard on a Bond film because it's a big budget for them and every hour costs money. So, and the location work is the hardest for them, for the producers, because they've got to make sure they get it in the can on that day. Once you're in the studios, you know, you have more flexibility. So
you went to Vienna as well, of course, and the famous Prater Wheel.
We opened in Vienna. The first 2 weeks of shooting, we were there. And we shot in that wonderful, Prater. Was it? What is it called?
Yeah, the Prater. Yeah, I have been.
What is that? You mean the
with the wheel?
You're talking about the fun fair.
The fun fair, yeah. There was the ghost ride, the roller coaster, and then the wheel. Yeah.
That roller coaster was another one that I had a bit of a problem with. We were night shooting there when there were no crowds. Did have a problem with that. I really, because I got vertigo. So going down these, you know, we did two or three takes of it, but say they put a camera, but oh my God, I felt like my stomach was leaping out and then I was going to jump out. I did not enjoy it at all. Timothy was laughing through it all, but I did not enjoy it. I was really glad when we'd done our two takes or three takes. I was like, oh, don't make me go up there again.
He won you that thing, didn't he? Shooting in the shooting contest, he won you that sort of Dumbo elephant character.
Yeah.
Stuff. So, yeah. You don't still have that, do you, Marianne?
No, I never owned it. It's part of the props.
It reminded me.
I never had that. Was a big. It was an elephant, wasn't it?
A big elephant.
I never saw it. In fact, once we did shot it, it was gone. Was it? Once we shot the scene.
If you've seen the new Bond film, there's obviously another little toy in that. So it reminded me of that. But
was the toy in the new Bond film? I don't remember.
The child's toy, his child's toy, Doodoo. I don't know whether you remember.
I don't remember.
Yeah, his girl at the end was carrying it around with her. And it's, yeah.
No, I do not remember. I went to the premiere
here
in London. And sometimes when you go to a royal premiere, you get a bit distracted. It's not like going to a screening and you I don't really remember. I mean, I remember other things in the film, Daniel being really great and many good things about it. But don't remember that toy.
Take me on the wheel.
What's wrong? Why do we stop?
I arranged it. We could be here all night.
Don't.
impossible. Knowing you only 2 days and all I can think of is how we would be together.
Don't think. Just let it happen.
Going on to the No Time to Die, do you think that Daniel Craig has certainly followed in the footsteps of Timothy Dalton in terms of his portrayal as Bond?
It was a decision that very cleverly Barbara Broccoli felt that after the Twin Towers 9/11, that Bond could not come back. It needed to be really like more of a killer, more edge, more modern. With what was going on in the world, you know, she's the one who fought for Daniel Craig with her brother Michael Wilson for the studios to accept Daniel Craig, because he was not a big star then, but he was a very, very good working actor. And they won, and Daniel, and they were very, very clever about Barbara was very clever about that move, because I think the Daniel Craig's Bond movies have grossed more money than any other Bond movies. I know times have changed as far as grossing money, but they have been the most successful Bond movies, certainly three or four of the ones he did. Three at Skyfall and Casino Royale, and huge hit. And this one's been was number one at the box office worldwide for a long time. So, you know, they're very clever in their choices, and they think about it very carefully. And so, yeah, that was his last, what do you call it, swan song?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wrong dance.
Final.
Yeah.
I know, obviously, in the new films has been a real, in the Craig films has been a real kind of effort to put emphasis on the weight of Bond's relationships with women. Now, in my opinion, this is possibly controversial, Bond's relationship with Cara, I think, is the most believable romance of the whole franchise. If Bond ended up with any of the Bond girls long term, it's Cara for me. You know, she's who he marries, because I think it's such a romantic and sweet film. And I wondered how much
sweet.
You know, with John Glenn being quite relaxed, you know, you're saying how much of Cara's kind of character, because she is so sweet, isn't she? She is naive, but also she's really brave. She's really courageous. Yeah. And how much kind of freedom did you and Timothy have to kind of develop, to portray that relationship, kind of develop that on screen?
Really, there was a lot of freedom in trying to be authentic, you know, and emotionally in the right place. But the lack of freedom that you have in film is time. But John was always trying to give us, you know, as much time as much rehearsal time. Sometimes when we were on vacation, there was no time, but he always respected that. So no, it was very comfortable. I have to say, they respected for the actors to find the tone of the scene and it being authentic.
Where have you been, James? You were gone so long, I was worried.
It's always nice to be missed. Still no sign of Yorgi. No, please. Go on playing.
No. Let's have a drink.
You remembered. To us.
Nazdravie. Did I get it right?
Perfect. What's the matter? Cara, it's time I told you the truth. I'm not a friend of Yorgi's. I'm a British agent looking for him. He's betrayed us all, Cara. The Russians, the British, even you. He told us a sniper might try to kill him. Then he set you up as the sniper, Cara. He wants you dead. You knew too much.
Liar! You pretended to love me. I telephoned Whitaker. Georgi was there. He told me the truth. You're a KGB agent using me to find him and kill him.
No, that's not true.
That's chloral hydrate.
Keep your hands off!
Listen to me!
You got that when the rifle was shot out of your hand.
How do you know?
Because I was the... I was the man sent to kill you.
Why didn't you?
I think Tim will all his work, you know, is always very, very much comes from a true place, whatever character he plays. So it was great. And I mean, I have to say, Tim was so good in convincing me that he was Bond, that I was sort of transported by his acting, by him, his character. So that proves that he was, what a good actor he is, because I leave as Bond, as my Bond. So you know, that's thanks to Tim a lot, and thanks to John Glenn's sensitivity, understanding, and, as you say, giving us the respect and freedom to find the tone of that scene, the rhythm, you know. And so yeah, we did, to answer a long answer, we did have the freedom. I'm just thinking, sometimes you don't have the freedom because suddenly there's no time, you're on location. You've just got to, you know, wing it. And sometimes winging it can be okay, good too. And very sort of, you know, spontaneous in the moment. But we were very lucky. We were very lucky.
And it really shows, doesn't it? I think, you know, there are so many touching moments in the film between, you know, like even at the end where the plane is crashed. The plane is crashed and, you know, there's been the tense sort of fight hanging off the plane, and then you and Bond have escaped out the back. You and Bond, Car and Bond. And excited now. And you hold, you know, you hold hands.
Well,
just so many like touching little moments for me that portray a depth of relationship that I don't think you get in any other Bond film.
Really? Personally. My God. Mm. Well, I'm very lucky to be interviewed by that's very sweet of you. Really, really sweet of you. Thank you. Thank you.
You were fantastic. We're free.
Kara, we're inside a Russian airbase in the middle of Afghanistan. I'll try the small key.
At least we're together.
Terrific. Come on.
Well, I don't know if you've seen a documentary that I produced.
Yes, yeah.
Bond Girls Are Forever.
Fantastic.
So there you get a sort of an idea of the evolution of how the character and the relationship evolved over time between the relationship between the Bond girl and the Bond woman, or the Bond girl, and James Bond. So it was very interesting to hear all the point of views and the takes of the actresses, what they experienced. And and I think everybody has their favorite, you know. There's no right or wrong, but everybody has their favorite, you know, favorite Bond girl, you know. It's normal.
It's generational, as you say, isn't it? You know, I grew up Bond, you know, Living Daylights is my Bond film, you know. That was the first Bond film that I saw, so, you know, for me, Bond is Timothy Dalton is Bond. But I also think that from a, even if you're not looking at it from a generational perspective, obviously, you know, I am biased, obviously, but I do think also that empirically, Kara is a kind of woman's Bond girl, I think, because she's, you know, she's sexy, but she's not sexualized. She's kind of got a realness about her, you know. She's not a kind of cardboard cutout of her character, and she has a real
challenges
him, and she has a real story arc.
That's always down to what's written on the page. Mm. So they decided to bring more of a story between in the relationship, and that is, you are dependent of that script and that the role that's on the page, and they gave me that role. Mm. They obviously thought I could do well with it, but it was on the page. I didn't improvise anything at all. It's all on the page. It was really nice. It was fun. It was nice. And it's so long ago now, but I'll always have some fun memories and lovely memories of shooting on that film. Very fond memories. It's unforgettable for anybody, I think, to be on a Bond movie. And I was very lucky to be on those locations, you know. Not like Judi Dench, who was marvellous, as M. She was always stuck in the studios in London, except I think one film where suddenly she went on location. There are two films she went on location in the end, but when I interviewed her, she was not travelling at all. She was just stuck in the studio. She didn't get that luck, but then she did. But yeah, anyway, yeah. No, very, very, and I love the locations where we went. I love Morocco and Vienna. It was really, really nice. There's nothing faulty about that experience. Nothing. There's no criticism to make at all. It was really very special.
You mentioned about obviously being at the royal premiere of No Time to Die, but obviously The Living Daylights got a royal.
We did with Diana and
Charles and Diane.
Charles. And it was quite funny because it was organized for Timothy and I to go to the premiere together. And he came, I lived in Fulham, and he came in one of those big cars that they had, and there's so much traffic in Fulham in the small little roads, streets. We got stuck in Fulham Broadway and the traffic and all that. And by the time we arrived in Leicester Square, they had shut, you know, the possibility of coming all the way in front of the cinema with the car at the Odeon Leicester Square. And we had to go through with the car, but we just arrived late when they were shutting it because of the royal family. And the policeman there, the Bobby, wouldn't let us in. And he didn't believe anything that Timothy was saying. And Timothy, I'm the lead in the Bond movie. And he says, yeah. And you're going to tell me now that you're George Lazenby, you know. And so we had to get out of the car and move through the crowds. And because we were unknowns in the Bond, you know, fan world, completely unknowns. And we had to move in the crowd, and I was wearing a wonderful Emmanuel Ungaro dress, which was quite tight around the ankles. So I was walking like a little geisha. And it was very, very, very a heat wave. And anyway, we arrived late, and then you have to be there for when Diana and Prince Charles came to say hello to us before we went into the screening. But then I was sitting next to Prince Charles, and unfortunate for him, he kept asking me all these questions about stunts and about all the scenes that he was interested in, which were not the love scenes, but more the scenes with Tim and the stunts. And I couldn't answer any of the questions he was asking. So it was quite funny. I was a bit... But he was very excited by it. He had fun watching it. He really enjoyed it. And I guess Diana enjoyed it too. And they had come on set once while we were at Pinewood. So, yeah, it was a lovely royal premiere. It was lovely. And those were the days when royal premieres were more intimate, now it's like a zoo. It's just like, it just kind of lost the romance anyway of the red carpet. It's all a bit sort of on a massive scale now for the young generation, but not me anymore. So I very much was very lucky. We had some lovely premieres around the world. So there we are.
Do you want another ride?
Thank you so much for joining us. And like we say, we're obsessed with The Living Daylights and Cara. Such an amazing
I'm so glad. It's really nice to hear that because it's always nice to hear. And everybody has, as I said, you know, different opinions. So it's really nice to hear that you love it even today.
Not at all.
It's great entertainment, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you liked also Cara Milovi. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Love her.
The accent.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And very, very happy to talk to you. And I'm so glad that you, The Living Daylights is one of your favourites. You probably said that to all of them.
No.
Genuinely. No,
it really is. Really is. Oh, love Tim as well.
That's very, very, very nice to hear. Take care and and all the best.
Thank you, Marianne.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
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 Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You didn't think I'd miss this performance, did you?
Oh,
Junior. Really the best.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.